Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you. Hour number two today, Tuesday, July the 28th, 2020, 728. 2020, 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, and we are having a great show this morning. We want to thank the 68th governor of the state of Ohio, Ted Strickland, for joining us in hour number one to talk about the upcoming presidential campaign, the effects of coronavirus, COVID-19 here in Ohio, and certainly all the racial unrest that has been going on in the capital city of Columbus, Ohio, where, of course, the governor makes his residence. So we thank Ted Strickland for coming on, Governor Strickland, and I got an email from him, and he will be back on very soon because there is something else he would like to talk about that we did not get to this morning. An hour is only so long, and that you will find that this hour, too, because this hour we're joined by one of my favorite people. He's getting up early this morning as he is out on the West Coast. He is one of my favorite people and probably the best person to talk to at this point, in my opinion, when it comes to the mess that we are in, this pandemic that we call coronavirus COVID-19. So many parts changing all the time. Is it better? Is it worse? What should we do? What are we going to do with the masks? Do the masks work? Is a vaccine on the way? None of us really know. But a person who has a good handle on this, because he's been in the medical profession so long and has written so many best-selling books, and you probably remember him best as the top medical correspondent on the Today Show for so many years. What a pleasure it is always to welcome to these microphones Dr. Art Uhlein. Dr. Uhlein, good morning. Are you there, Dr. Uhlein? Doctor. Well, hold on a second, and we will get Dr. Uhlein back on the line here. Now, see, those are the things that happen in live radio. You give a nice intro, and then the guest is not there. But, you know, it's interesting, because phones sometimes don't work exactly as you want them to. But we will get Dr. Uhlein back on the line here momentarily. Stick with us here. And as I say, Governor Strickland does want to come back on the program and talk about something, which we definitely want to talk to him about. Let's give this another try here. Dr. Uhlein, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me, Scott?
I can hear you now. We're in good shape.
A little scary there to be on hold 2,500 miles away.
Did you hear the intro I gave you, Dr. Uhlein?
I did hear it, and I disclaim everything you said except the nice things.
Well, I thought, oh man, we're going now, and I don't think he heard the intro. Holy moly, do I have to do that again? Because it's all from memory.
No, you don't have to do it again. Thank you for your kind words. You are the only man in America for whom I would get up at this hour.
I appreciate that. For those out there listening, Dr. Uhlein is out on the West Coast, so it is just after 6 o'clock out there, 6 a.m., so we appreciate him for doing that. Dr. Uhlein, here we are in this pandemic now since mid-March. In your opinion, where are we in the United States?
Well, you described it perfectly in one word, Scott. You used the word mess. And it's a mess. And I'm pleased to report that we are learning a tremendous amount about this disease in the last week or two. It is astonishing the speed with which science is learning about this new disease. But I am afraid that I have to report that most of the news is not good. The good news gets the headlines. Yes, there are several vaccine candidates. Yes, they appear to be safe. Yes, we're going to have one sometime in the next year. And that's a miracle. It would have taken 10 years when I was in medical school to make this happen. But the bad news, I think, is best stated by a few words in an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association. In the title, they say, COVID-19, uncertain and out of control. We passed 4 million cases in the U.S. In the last week, about 65,000 new ones. And we passed 146,000 deaths. Now, you could say, well, you know, yes, that's because we have such a large country. In fact, we are doing really poorly compared to the rest of the developed world. We have the ninth worst death rate. And the death rate is measured as the number of people per 100,000 U.S. residents or per million residents who die. We have a massive number of cases undiagnosed. We don't know where this is, because although we have done a tremendous amount of testing, the president is correct when he says we have done more tests than anyone else in the world. But as a fraction of our population, we are doing very, very poorly. We have 250 million people untested. That's unspeakable. We have an epidemic that is not only out of control in some parts of our country, but getting worse. Ohio is a state that's doing pretty well, but we've got some states in this country that are literally out of control. The number of new cases is increasing. The number of deaths is increasing in these states. And we just need to be concerned about this. If you look at a map of the United States, a state like Ohio is in white. It means it's really done a good job. It's got this thing slowed or nearly stopped. But you look at Missouri, totally out of control. Louisiana skyrocketing. Oklahoma, Texas, Florida, Nevada. You look at states like North Dakota, Indiana, Minnesota, Maryland, Virginia, they're pink, they're dark pink. California, where I live, is kind of halfway in between. And this is inexcusable at this point in an epidemic, in a pandemic. And we should be asking ourselves why. And more important, what can we do about it? So I want to come back to the announcement that preceded your entry to the show. One of the announcements warned about the epidemic and said, wash your hands and stay physically distanced apart. And I'm concerned about what it did not say. It did not say wear a mask, because the research is stunningly clear on this. But if everyone in this country wore a mask every time they stepped out the door, and maybe in some multi-generational homes, if they wore masks even in their homes, I think there'd be another 100,000 people alive. I think this epidemic would be under control. And my thinking is not based on just my opinion and conjecture, but on reading of the medical literature, which shows that universal wearing of masks is, if not the most single effective thing we could do to stop the spread of this disease, certainly in the top two.
Why is that so hard to comprehend? Here in Ohio, last week we went under a statewide mask mandate for the first time, and people are not happy about this. Why is wearing that mask such a problem for so many people?
I wish I could answer that question, because common sense would tell you to wear a mask in these conditions. An IQ of 75 would tell you it makes sense to wear a mask. A love of life, of concern for others, would tell you to wear a mask. And I must tell you, here now in Los Angeles, it is very, very difficult to find someone who is not wearing a mask. People are really taking this thing seriously now. But my wife and I have a home in Utah as well, and we just returned from a driving trip to Utah. Wouldn't get me on an airplane. And probably only 10 to 20% of the people we encountered were wearing masks, except in markets or locations where they said no mask, no entry. It's irrational, this notion that you're taking away my liberty. Yeah, I take away your liberty when I tell you you have to wear a seatbelt. I take away your liberty when I tell you the speed limit is 80 miles an hour on the highway. I take away your liberty all the time. But for crying out loud, the mask can save your life. I don't get it, Scott. I don't have an answer for that question.
Well, the thinking on this, Dr. Uhlein, because I've heard it, is this is all a hoax. It's all phony. And after the election in November, this will all go away.
I'll tell you what's going to take care of that kind of thinking. By November 1st, there will be 200,000 dead, at least, in this country. We're at 147,000 today, with 1,000 more people dying every day. If we continue at this rate by next spring, there will be 300,000 to 400,000 people dead. And everyone in this country will know someone who's really dead. They won't answer their phone. They'll be 6 feet under. Their family will be crying. And then maybe people will take this seriously then. It's a great, I can tell you, my wife and I take this so seriously that when our family, my daughter and son-in-law and their adult children come to visit us, we sit distance, not 6 feet away from each other, but 10 feet away from each other in the backyard. Mm. When we step out of this house, we're not carrying a mask. We are wearing a mask. And there's a reason why we are so vigilant. Number one, we know this is real. And number two, at our ages, I just turned 84, Scott. At our ages, if I get sick, the odds are overwhelming that it will not be an asymptomatic illness, but it will be a serious illness. And my chance of requiring the hospital for care is probably 3, 4, 5 times greater than that of a 40-year-old. And I'm in good shape. Mm. But my chance of coming out of that hospital, based on the early statistics, my chance of coming out alive is 20%.
Dr. Uhlein, you were talking about where we'll be, where we possibly could be next spring, possibly by the time the election comes about this coming November, less than 100 days from now. When is it conceivable? Because every day there's something new on social media or the internet or a periodical about a vaccine. When is it conceivable that there will be a vaccine that is readily available to people that will at least help us along the way with this?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, and I can't tell you when that'll happen, but I can tell you that it will be miraculously soon, which probably means sometime after the first of the year, early spring, we'll see the first doses. here's the problem with a vaccine. The problem with what we're beginning to learn about this vaccine is we don't know how long it will work. There's already evidence. There's good evidence that you get the vaccine, any one of several. They've tested several now. And you will build antibodies, which is a sign of resistance against the disease. What is of great concern to the scientists is the fact that the level of these antibodies drop very rapidly. And here's what that tells us based on experience with other vaccines. It is almost certainly going to be necessary to have two shots to get the full strength immunity you need to protect yourself. Now, what do we know about vaccines that require two shots? We know that a huge percentage of people never come back for the second shot. We also know that if a vaccine, if the antibodies decline so rapidly after an immunization, the strength of the protection may not be perfect. So we have no assurance that even two shots of this vaccine will protect you a year or two down the road from this. What else do we know about vaccines? We know that there are a huge group of people, they've been labeled anti-vaxxers. I label them uninformed. They're afraid of vaccines. They've been told that these diseases are hoaxes. And the problem is that they not only put their own families at risk, but of course they put us at risk also if we're not able to get the vaccine. There are some people who, you know, they're too sick to get the vaccine initially. They're at the end of the line, and these people are being put at risk. So the news about the vaccines is that we've accomplished a miracle in developing vaccines so quickly. And the bad news is we don't know how protective we'll be. We don't know how many people will take them, and we don't know how long the immunity will last.
Mm. What will this ever be eradicated? Or is this going to be one of those diseases that is with us forever in some form or fashion?
Give me another 20 years and I'll be able to give you an intelligent answer to that question. Mm. We don't know. I don't mean to be funny about it. One of the things we need to recognize is how much we don't know about what we don't know. For example, and some of these things, you can't answer those questions without time. So, for example, we were told last week that it was a mild disease, that most people who get the disease, you know, just, they don't even know they have it. They're asymptomatic. Of course, the 145,000 people who are dead, their families know they got the disease. Let me just read to you a couple of headlines or a couple of conclusions that have come out in the research just in the past week. Long-term effects of COVID. The researchers published a study based on interviews with 270 COVID-19 patients who had mild illnesses. They did not require hospitalization. And they interviewed them 3 weeks after they were tested for the disease and got a positive test. Most of these younger people, half of them under the age of 50. And what they found is that these people continued to be sick, to have symptoms 3 weeks later. Lingering symptoms. What could that be? Well, another study has suggested that one of the things it could be is inflammation of the heart, because they're now starting to do imaging, MRI, very, very exotically, exquisitely sensitive test of the heart in patients who have recovered from COVID, and they're finding evidence of inflammation in the heart, inflammation of heart muscle cells. And if you're a cardiologist, you ask yourself, uh-oh, what's next? And the logical consequence of inflammation of the heart is heart failure down the road. Because inflammation of the heart leads to loss of muscle, scarring of the heart, and down the road, premature heart failure. That's terrifying. The notion that you may have a mild case of COVID-19, inflammation of the heart, that at some point down the road takes you out. Another study shows that there's a very high incidence of what we call thrombosis in patients with COVID. This is abnormal blood clotting that occurs in blood vessels without any obvious cause. This is very concerning because, of course, abnormal clotting leads to things like heart attack and stroke. We're learning now that people who are obese have 40% increase of risk of dying of COVID. And 40% of our country is obese. 40% of our entire population is at catastrophic risk with a disease like COVID. So I could go on and on, but I can't, because we don't know what we don't know. We're only going to learn what the real consequences are of this disease in the next year or two.
Dr. Yulin, and I want to phrase this exactly this way, because this was interesting to a lot of people last week, and really the first time I had heard this. Now, this whole thing starts back in March, and clearly we were most worried about the elderly. Lockdowns at assisted living centers, lockdowns on nursing homes. If you're over a certain age, don't you dare go outside. They are our vulnerable group. Now, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that age group, by and large, does understand that now. And now, here we are in July, late July, and this started in mid-March, and the group that is getting this more than anybody else now is people in their 20s, are people in their 20s, younger people. Was that a bad, even though we know that seniors are very susceptible, was it a bad idea to say that?
Well, actually, what they said was your risk of dying from the disease was greater if you were older, which is why all of us older folks really got religion. They didn't say your risk of COVID was lower. And at the time, these announcements were going out, and by the way, it was much earlier than March that we knew about this disease. But at that time, we didn't know that COVID could cause your heart to be inflamed. We didn't know that COVID, because we hadn't seen it enough of it yet, we didn't know that COVID could cause clotting in your blood vessels, leading to stroke. We didn't know that COVID could cause this multi-system inflammatory disease in children and kill children. We didn't see enough of it to know, and this country was not prepared. We had closed the pandemic office. There was an Office of Global Pandemic Affairs. That was the name of it. And it was situated in the office, the National Security Council's office, which is where a global pandemic office should probably sit. And it was closed. Now, they'll tell you, oh, no, 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 no. It wasn't closed. It was just moved to the State Department and merged with another office. To which I would say, moved to the State Department? You would take a global pandemic office, which is a national security issue, a national health issue, and move it to the pandemic, to the State Department? That makes sense to me. Some countries were prepared. Singapore, incredibly well prepared. Hong Kong, incredibly well prepared. And the disease was stopped in its tracks in countries like that. Some countries just put the locks on everything. I mean, talk about locking down countries like Germany and Finland and Norway. And countries right next door to them did not lock down. Sweden's a good example. Everybody said, look at Sweden. You know, they're letting people do anything they want, and they're doing just fine. Really? The mortality rate in Sweden is 6 times higher than in Finland and Norway, the two neighboring countries, because they locked down, and Sweden did not. So, I am troubled at every single level I look at. I look at the federal level of response. I look not just the political level. I look at the CDC. I look at the NIH and the decisions they made, and I'm upset. I look at the reaction of the general public. I look at the conspiracy theorists, and I am just furious. But there's only one thing I can do. I got to go back to being Dr. Art Uhlein. I am a physician, and I need your listeners to know one thing. That the best thing, that this is two things. This is really serious. This pandemic is really serious, and it affects the young as well as the old. And you can protect yourself. The single most effective way to protect yourself is with a mask and not exposing yourself to someone who isn't wearing a mask. Please, please put your masks on.
Dr. Uhlein, this time goes by too fast, and I know you'll come back with us, but in the final 20 minutes, there are three things I really want to broach in this conversation. And I want to start here about this pandemic office. And I'm going to say it exactly this way so it's not political. If this pandemic had happened 15 years ago under Republican President George W. Bush, and the pandemic office was up and running as it had been for a long time, what would have been different in America?
I need to take a deep breath because I don't want to be political about it, and because this is conjecture. So I'm not going to answer that question. I do think it would have been different. Instead, what I would rather, the question I'd rather answer would be, Dr. Uhlein, if you were president, what would you do today? It's not constructive to go back, and people will, anything I say, people will interpret as political. So I would rather give some advice that people could put into use today. May I do that?
Go right ahead.
Number one, learn as much as you can about the pandemic. I am probably telling some of your listeners things they have never heard before, like heart inflammation and multi-system inflammatory disease and extremely long-term effects and antibody titers wearing off. And I would urge your listeners to go to the internet to trusted sources, not to Facebook, but to the American Medical Association's website, to Medscape, to the National Institute of Health website, to the Institute of Medicine, and search trusted sites, the sites that we physicians use, for information. Number one, become informed. Number two, take this thing seriously for two reasons. And one reason is that you are at risk yourself. And the second reason is that if you take risks, you put other people like me and like your father and grandfather at risk. And that's just not right. Number three, do everything that trusted sources like me. I am a trusted source. I'm proud to say that. Every simple thing that trusted sources tell you to do. And what do we tell you to do? Number one, we tell you to stay healthy. A good immune system, good resistance is the best thing. So, yes, get your sleep and eat well. Number two, minimize your exposures. Don't do silly things. Don't put yourself in crowds. Stay outdoors as much as you can. And when you must be out and anywhere near people, keep your distance. 6 feet will protect you from the larger droplets, physical distance. And wear a mask, which will protect you from the smaller droplets and will protect others from your smaller droplets. Wash your hands. I don't have to wash my hands. I don't go out of my house. But if you do go out of your house and do you do expose yourself to people, places, and things that could contaminate your hands with virus, for crying out loud, wash your hands with soap and water. One of the things we know is that as lethal as this virus is, it's just totally susceptible to soap and water. Soap breaks down the outer shell, and this virus is dead if you use soap and water on your hands for 20 seconds. So we can all do those things. And if every single one of us, every single one of us did those things, kept our distance, avoided crowds indoors, wore masks, and washed our hands after exposures, this virus would be stopped in its tracks in this country in 2 weeks.
And why do you think we can't do that?
Oh, man. You're asking the tough question, okay? Because we have no one to blame for ourselves. There are some people who are blaming the president. Oh, he's misleading everybody. He's lying. They're blaming the conspiracy theorists. Well, you know, it's their fault. They've undermined. They're blaming the protesters. Oh, it's the protest. No. It's each and every one of us. And I will repeat what I said earlier. If every single one of us avoided crowds indoors, wore masks, and urged others to wear masks, and washed our hands after exposure, we have the power to stop this epidemic in its tracks.
It's fascinating, and I think a lot of this comes down to human psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are, I guess. If you just had to guess at this, what is the psychology? Is it nobody in my family has died? Is nobody I know has this? Is that what the problem is here?
Oh, it's not as simple as that. Some of it is the feelings that young people have of immortality. That, by the way, has been labeled by some as stupidity. I won't use that term. Some of it has to do with this sense of wanting to maintain control, this paranoia that infects this country at this time. They're trying to take everything away from me. No, no, we're trying to keep you alive. A lot of this has to do with poverty. I mean, let's face it, Scott. I'm sitting here in my house. I've got people delivering the food to me. I can allow it to sit on the doorstep. I don't have to go to work. I'm retired. I could go on and on about this, but it's very, very clear that this disease affects people who are crowded into tenements more than it affects people like me, single homeowners. It's very clear that it affects people who lack access to medical care. So there is a fundamental inequity in the system. It's a very complex issue, and I think we make a mistake by trying to boil it down to one simple thing. I can tell you one thing for clear. If we don't do something about this, then we're going to be looking at 200,000 people dead by election day. We're going to be looking at 350,000 people dead by next summer. And there's no excuse for that.
Mm. And those are grim numbers, but they are true. So we've got to do, with 10 minutes left, and this, I don't know how this is going to contribute, so we're going to talk about this. In less than a month, public schools across this country are set to go back in session. At this point, they're still set to go back in session here in Ohio. Colleges are set to go back in session. In this area and in Ohio at this point, for the most part, by and large, high school sports have not been canceled. And we're talking about football on the field in less than a month. What is that going to do? Is that a good thing to be doing?
Well, we know what it's going to do. It's going to increase the spread of this disease. We know that. In the absence of a vaccine, we know that it will do it. How badly will it do it? It will do it horribly in some areas, where they just put the kids right back into school and crowd the classrooms. And it will do, it won't be a problem at Yale University, where my grandson will be going this fall, and where he has, where they are not allowing the students to come on campus. They're doing the education entirely remotely. The thing I don't understand, to honestly answer your question, I need to say we don't know what will happen. We can almost guarantee that the infection will spread. We don't know how fast it will spread. We don't know how many children will be infected. We don't know how many will take it home. Let's be honest, we don't know. So this is a giant experiment that will be taking place in some cities. Not all cities. I can tell you in Los Angeles, schools will not open. So if they open in Marion, you'll be one of those cities where we are experimenting with our children. And I can't wait to see the results. I pray that I'm wrong in my predictions.
One of the big things I think that gets lost in this is when my feet hit the floor in the morning, if I've got a child, if I've got an elderly parent, and none of us have it, thank goodness at this point, what do we do daily to not make it happen, to keep it from happening? If we have to continue on, if we're in that group that has to go to work, we have to go to the grocery store, the kids have to go back to school, what do we say to do to stop from getting this?
Well, there are a number of measures, most of them physical, that you can do to minimize the risk. You can keep yourselves distant. You can keep the children out of class, indoor classrooms that are crowded with recirculating air. You can wash your hands after exposure to other things. You can wear masks, extremely effective. You can consider taking some radical steps to protect your family. saying that, you know, the other kids are going to school, mine are not. That would be the decision in our family, by the way. We would not allow our children to go back to school. And by the way, you know, let me not be too flippant about that. We understand that that is not good for the children to be away from school, to miss their friends, to miss the socialization. We do not believe for a second that distant learning is as good as in-person learning. But if the risk we're taking with our child is the possibility that that child might get a minor infection that leads to cardiac inflammation, that leads to heart failure at the age of 30, why would I do that? Let me experiment, thank you, with someone else's children. I don't, there is no easy answer to this question, but I got to tell you, rushing your child into school may not be the best answer for that child. I don't know.
You know, Dr. Euling, here is the trajectory of events that happened here in Ohio, because I think it's interesting to this degree. In March, we learned about it on a big scale as citizens, and everything was shut down almost immediately within a week. Schools, stay-at-home orders, you can't be open at this late, nursing homes were on lockdown. This all happened. Now, we stayed that way pretty much into the beginning of June. Up till Memorial Day, we stayed that way. And our numbers did plateau, and we never hit the projected numbers that they thought we would. It was supposed to be, I think, 10,000 a day, something like that, people were supposed to be infected. We never got that high, and we plateaued, and there were days in the county where I sit where we had no new cases, period. That happened in early June. Well, then we opened the restaurants, we opened the bars, we opened the amusement parks, we opened the zoo, and now we are a red county, which in Ohio means mandatory masks, even though now all of Ohio is under mandatory mask orders because of this. With no vaccine and no change, really, except that, hey, you know about this, and a lot of governors made this decision, a lot of public officials did. Why did we open everything back up?
Politics, economics, shutting everything down is destroying some lives economically. A friend of mine is going bankrupt. He's going to lose his business. So I don't want to give you a simple answer. You know, this is not stupidity. But I just don't think that people realized how catastrophic the consequences might be. I'm looking at the curve right now of cases for Ohio, and you had this huge peak right around the end of April with 1,270 new cases in a day. And yes, by June, you were down to 350. You had cut it by more than a third. And now I'm looking at last week, and you had 1,510 cases in Ohio on July 23rd. And some of those people are going to die. Going to die. Those are not cases. Those are people. And 5% of them are going to die. That's 75 people. Are going to die as a result of that reopening decision. Now, do you want to put 7, 18, 27 people into bankruptcy to save those? That's something the people of Ohio will have to decide, isn't it? These are not easy answers. One of the men in this country I respect the most is Dr. Mike Osterholm, who predicted this epidemic, everything that's happening, he predicted in a book he wrote in 2016. He's at the University of Minnesota. He's one of the most brilliant men I have seen. I don't know him. And everything he tells you about this disease he prefaces with the comment that anything I tell you right now may be proven wrong 6 weeks from now. We do not know what we do not know. And in this situation, I personally believe, I'm a physician, I personally believe we must make all the sacrifices in the interest of saving lives and saving bodies, saving health, protecting health. So, no, I wouldn't open the schools. And, yes, I would take the bankruptcies so 10 more people could live. That's not a decision for me to make.
Dr. Uline, with about 30 seconds left here, what is the silver lining in this right now? It's a bad time. Is there any silver lining?
We will get through it, Scott. We will get through this. When? At what cost? I don't know. But I do have faith in the people of this country to ultimately, at some point, come together to protect each other. And I pray that happens sooner rather than later.
You know, I say it every day, and I think it's my mantra in a way, and maybe it sounds trivial in these times, but this too shall pass, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Art Uline, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, one of my favorite people. I can't thank you enough for getting up early. It's always my pleasure, as I say, and I really want you to come back soon because we don't know where this is going, and there's so much to talk about that doesn't get played on television or the internet in those three-minute
right.
clips where we can have a conversation. Thank you, Dr.
Right.
Uline.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Stay safe.
Dr. Art Uline, holy moly. Don't forget today we've got Voice of a People with Linda Sims at 4, the Pastor Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker at 5, and the Adam the Computer Guy show at 2 p.m. Pay attention. That's the best we can say. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Is there a role?
And he says, I don't want your fivers. I got better acts than you upstairs. He says, I'll call you when I have a vacancy. I says, take your time, Lord.
WWGH Radio, streaming live on the www.wgh.